And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Well, today we go behind the scenes and learn more about the incredible 40-year career of the Bee Gees. They were pop music creation machines with scads of number one hits, albums, and prolific writers for other well-known artists as well. Joining us now is rock historian David M. Meyer. He's written The Bee Gees, The Biography. Welcome to you, David Myers. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for being here. So as I was preparing for today's show, getting the music and the system, a colleague of mine asked me, I can understand why you'd want to be a Beatles expert, but Bee Gees, why would you want to do that? So, and I thought echoes a theme in your book that the Bee Gees never received the credit that you thought they deserved.
Right. I went on a real journey of exploration with this book. When I started it, I was as agnostic on the Bee Gees as anybody. You know, I think I regarded them with a kind of genial contempt that I think everybody feels about them. They love their songs. They think they're a little ridiculous. The more I learned about their story, the more I learned about the breadth of their songwriting, their technical expertise, the more I began to respect them. And the more deeply you burrow into their music, surprisingly, the better it becomes.
So why were they so misunderstood?
Well, as I say in the book, they were the worst dressers in the history of rock and roll, I think, bar none. They always looked kind of silly. They had no understanding of good PR, proper public presentation. And they had the sort of fatal error of being inescapable on the airways for 18 months. So the backlash against them, I think, was unfair, but it endured.
You mean the Saturday Night Fever?
Yeah.
Right.
Era.
Yeah.
I'd like to begin going back. They were born to an extremely poor family in Manchester, England, is that right?
Yes.
And they were forced to go to Australia. Tell us that story. Why were they forced to leave?
Well, in post-war England, there was a lot of more or less forced immigration to Australia to try and build up the Australian economy and population. And the three brothers, Barry the eldest and the two twins, Robin and Morris, were hardcore juvenile delinquents and kind of pyros. They went around setting a lot of fires. And here they are in the toughest town in England, and the cops eventually came to the house and said, the boys are going to reform school or you're going to Australia. And that was it. And it was something like $10 for each adult and $5 for each child to be shipped off to Australia, and they were.
When did they start the singing?
They started the singing when they were very, very young, when the twins were like 10 and Barry was like 12. They started singing in amateur contests in England, and then they began to sing in the gutters in England and in Australia for change thrown at
them. They were buskers.
Yes, they were buskers.
Now, their parents were both musicians?
Well, their dad was a drummer. He was a big band drummer. Their mom was a sometime singer, but she wasn't really that much of a musician. She was more of an amateur. He had a real career for a good while as a drummer.
And did they urge their kids to become musicians, or was it something that just happened naturally?
It was something that happened naturally. The Bee Gees always said that they sang together from their earliest memories, that they had a natural harmony. And then when they began to make money in Australia, even with spare change on the street, they were out earning their parents, and so they became the earners for the family.
And they had one hit in Australia.
Yes, they had this hit later on called, oh, do you want to...
Yeah, well, go
well,
ahead.
It's called Set Spicks it and Specks, which is spelled S-P-I-C-K-S, as in, as you said earlier, spick and span. It's called Spicks and Specks, and it became a hit just as they left Australia for England.
So this is about the earliest recording of them we would have.
Well, it's the earliest hit. They made a lot of pop records in Australia when they were young teenagers.
So this is their first hit in Australia. Did it go to number one?
Or? Yes, it went to number one in Australia, and it had some chart time in England as well.
Okay, so let's listen to it.
I remember that.
You do? I had never heard it. It's a great pop song. Where is the light? Very Hermits Hermits.
Yeah, it is.
In my streets. And where are the friends I could meet? I could meet. Where are the girls?
You hear Barry very strong.
Oh, yeah, you can really hear Barry coming over.
Now, did they have any formal music training?
Absolutely none, and later they refused to. And Barry and Robin both said, we might unlearn something that we don't know that we know how to do. They very much did not want formal training. And in their early hits, they had string arrangers when they were in England. But later on, either Barry or Robin would hum the whole string arrangement that they wanted, and someone would transcribe it and write it. And
so they couldn't even write music?
No, they could not write music, but Barry heard everything in his
head.
And
had perfect hit pitch.
Absolutely perfect.
So when they had this hit, did they decide to return to England because they had the hit, or was it just coincidental that that's when they were returning?
No, that's a really interesting question. They felt they had gone as far as they could in England, in Australia. Barry was writing hits for other Australians. They were very frustrated with their lack of success, and they just up and decided that they were going to go, that they thought they were ready. And when they left, they didn't know the song was a hit, and it rose on the charts as they were on their ship heading to England. They got the good news when they got to England.
And who gave them that good news?
Well, they found it was in the charts, but their father had reached out to Robert Stigwood, you know, one of the most significant managers in rock and roll history, who at the time was working with Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager. And the myth goes that their dad sent Stigwood acetates, and he played it and wanted to sign the band. But it also turns out other record professionals in Australia had let Stigwood know they were coming. But essentially, they went from, you know, the smallest possible regional market to the second most powerful manager in rock and roll, like that.
And the relationship with Brian Epstein and Stigwood and the Beatles and the Bee Gees.
Well, Epstein ran the show, and the Bee Gees were very much Stigwood's creation, and Epstein never liked them, and the Bee Gees never liked Stigwood. And when Stigwood gave the Bee Gees £1,000 for a perpetual 50% right of their songwriting, Epstein screamed at him, said it was the worst deal that had ever been made.
Screamed it
at
Stigwood.
Said it was £1,000 for their songwriting, waste of money.
And so did the Bee Gees ever have dealings with the Beatles except for being accused of impersonating them? What was their relation? Did they have a relationship?
No. Later, during John Lennon's Lost Weekend period, Morris did a lot of drinking with him. And when Morris was 17 years old, he used to hang out in some clubs that many rock stars hung out in, and he would drink with Lennon. But their relationship with the Beatles was one of wishing the Beatles would notice them in some way.
So the Bee Gees have arrived in Great Britain, and how did their career take off there?
Well, Stigwood got them in a studio and had them writing and promoted them very, very hard and promoted them as the next Beatles and pushed hard on them the notion that they had a Beatlesque sound.
And so what was their first hit once they got to England?
Well, that was their England. Massachusetts in 1967 was their first hit.
Okay. And they had never been to the U.S. They probably didn't know what Massachusetts was.
No, they had no idea. They say plainly. They weren't even sure how to pronounce it.
All right, let's listen to that. That was 67?
Yes.
Okay. Now, is that Robin?
That's Robin. It's really remarkable how many Bee Gees songs everyone has in their head.
How did this track in the U.S.?
Hit number 11.
Now, Barry wrote this as well?
Barry and Robin wrote this.
Okay. So as you just mentioned about how we know so many of these things, they get stuck in our head. What was it about their writing that had this hook?
Well, I just thought hearing this song for the millionth time, that I think their pop genius is really underrated. That they were phenomenal pop songwriters. They understood hooks, they understood bridges, they understood how a song could be. their pop craft. You know, maybe when we think of Smokey Robinson, you know, great pop songwriter. People just don't mention Barry and Robin in the same breath, and I really think they should. I mean, how old is this song? It just stands up so beautifully.
And they weren't always love songs.
No, they weren't always love songs. And who knows what these songs are about? I mean, they just don't make any rational sense at all, but they evoke some kind of emotion, which is also, I think, an attribute of a great pop song. You don't know what it means, but you feel something when you hear it.
You've said that the Bee Gees always seem to have their noses pressed to the glass of whatever scene they were supposed to be a part of. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that their upbringing as poor, badly dressed outsiders stayed with them forever. And there's always a sense of wanting to be appreciated more, you know, wanting to hang with the cool kids. Yet at the same time, they were by their nature, if you can say this of three people together, loners. You know, they trusted their family and nobody else. And they didn't seem that interested in becoming cool, which is almost de rigueur for anybody in that business.
You mentioned that, of course, they cared about money, but actually it was having the hit songs that was most important to them.
Yes.
To have number ones.
That's right. When I talked to their longtime producer and asked him how they felt about, you know, their huge success, he said to me all they ever cared about was being at the top of the charts, that their goal was always number ones, and anything that came with number ones was absolutely secondary. You know, Barry, I think, is one of the most driven people in show business. I mean, compared to him, Madonna is an amateur, and his ambition has never flagged, and he's always wanted number ones from 1967 to now.
Barry was sort of the alpha male of the group.
Yes.
Robin, say number two because he did so much songwriting.
Right.
Tell us more about Morris's role.
Well, you know, by the end of this book, Morris became my favorite Bee Gee. And I think Morris has a wonderful voice that people don't hear enough, but he made some great solo songs, and he liked to write kind of country music. And until his alcoholism got the better of him, and he later became clean and sober, he was the guy, if he could touch it, he could play it. You know, he played piano, he played mellotron, he played guitar, he played bass on their records. He was a great musician. And he willfully took a back seat between the struggles in the name of family harmony. So he made himself into the sacrificing middle brother, if you will.
So literally and figuratively.
Yes.
To keep the harmony.
Yes.
And how did Morris and Robin feel about Barry kind of taking over?
Well, when they had their huge acrimonious breakup in the early 70s, it was all about Barry not wanting Robin to sing lead as much and to trying to hold on to the role he had had as a little brother when they were 10 and he was 13. As they got to be 20 and they had all these number ones, they wanted to run their own careers, but Barry has always been the man in charge. I mean, it was always that way.
And they broke up, but they realized they couldn't make it on their own.
That's right. They discovered none of them could do as well individually as they did together. To do the thing they did best, they needed one another. I think it's a hard lesson to learn.
Now, before that breakup, let's get into this Otis Redding business.
Okay.
And, of course, the great Bee Gees song, To Love Somebody. Give us the background on that.
Well, when Barry was 20, he wrote this song for Otis Redding. And I say in the book that I'm an Otis fanatic. Among Otis fanatics, it is the greatest Otis Redding song.
Someone asked him to write it.
Yes, Stigwood asked him to write a song for Otis. And it's such a perfect song for Otis Redding. It's been covered by everyone. I think Graham Parsons and Eric Burdon do the two best versions, but 50 people have covered this song.
It's almost like yesterday.
Yes, it's almost like yesterday, and it is a great song.
How many people have recorded it?
I don't have the exact figure, but I could open the book and, you know,
like
rattle off 30 people, 30 well-known people, from Nina Simone to the Calypso star Mighty Sparrow to Graham Parsons. I mean, an incredible range.
Well, do you want to hear a little?
Yes.
Okay.
There's a light, a certain kind of light that never shone on me. I want my life to be a little.
Harps.
You know, if you take the embellishments off, it just so sounds like Booker T and the MGs, you know, cutting an Otis track. That really simple drumming, really simple bass lines, everything scaled way back.
You don't know what it's like. Baby, you to love somebody the way I love you. I see your face again. I know my friend man. You ain't got to be so black. And I'm glad. So, so, so glad. I'm a man.
It's hard to stop.
Can't you see what I am?
Yeah.
And he sings it really soulful.
Yeah.
Especially for Barry, he sings it.
But what good does it do if I ain't got you? Ain't got you. Baby, you don't know what it's like. Baby, you don't know what it's like to love somebody, to love somebody the way I love you. To love somebody the way I love you.
Now you said, and you almost hear a little of the falsetto there.
You know, it's funny, I was thinking that this time too. You hear a precursor of that falsetto in there.
Yeah. Now you said to love somebody should be enough to cement Barry Gibb's reputation as one of pop's most important songwriters and perhaps the one with the most underappreciated range and breadth.
That's right.
Why do you think that was?
Well, again, I think that their disco era really worked against their credibility after the disco era. And I also think that people tend to associate Barry only with the Bee Gees sound. But, you know, number ones are Barbra Streisand, Kenny Rogers, Dionne Warwick, Diana Ross, on and on and on, and purpose-built number ones. You know, he had an ear for other performers and what their best pop songs would be. And I've come to just stand in awe of him as a pop songwriter, and I would put him up with the four or five greatest pop songwriters in the second half of the century.
He wrote Islands in the Stream for Dolly Parton.
Oh, and he wrote it originally for Kenny Rogers, and then they brought Dolly into the studio and they sang it together.
I see.
The Bee Gees could knock off writing three hit songs in one sitting in like an hour.
Yeah. They just sat, it just poured out of them. You know, they always had it there, and when they were writing well together. I mean, the thing about the Bee Gees is almost every Bee Gees album is three amazing songs, one or two decent songs, and the rest sound like filler. I'm not sure they could tell always the difference between their best and their worst work, but to put three great songs on almost every record is, most bands can't do that either.
So we have one more, because then they hit their first career low in the late 60s, but we have one more 60s song.
Oh, good.
That, from 1968, right?
Yes.
Okay. Is that got to get a message? Yeah.
The preacher talked with me and he smiled. Hey, it's a newer live version.
Yeah, yeah.
Come and walk with me. Come and walk one more mile. Now for once in your life, you're alone. But you ain't got a dime.
Robin wrote this song.
I believe he did.
What do you think he was saying?
I haven't a clue. I mean, I listened to this song 50 times for the book. I haven't a clue. I mean, maybe in some way it's just some inarticulate crying out of, you know, I'm in love with you and you don't know it. I'm incredibly mad at you and you don't know it. You're a little baby and I can't speak to you. I mean, I have no idea.
Just
takes only her love, keeps me wearing this dirt. Now I'm crying, but deep down inside, well, I did it to him.
Our listeners may think they have the wrong station.
I know.
Yeah, it could be about a man awaiting execution. That was one popular theory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One more hour in my life.
You mentioned in the book that Robin's voice, people talking about it being tremolo, but you actually say it's vibrato. What's the difference?
Yeah, it's actually one of their producers said that it was more vibrato than falsetto, and I don't know what the difference is.
So so they were huge in the 60s. Then
yes.
they hit this wall and they experienced the first of several dips in their career. Why did that happen?
You know, it's not really clear to me why it happened. It was, you know, they sold 25 million records between 1967 and the early 70s. And then suddenly nobody wanted to hear them and they could not get booked. You know, they were playing.
And the hard rockers were getting more popular then.
Well, they were pop songwriters. I mean, you'd think there'd always be room on the chart for a pop songwriter. But their audience turned away from them, and they were playing the most horrible supper clubs in England, and they couldn't even sell those out. They just had vanished. And along with that vanishing came unhappiness with Stigwood about where the money was going and these huge squabbles over who was going to run the band.
The huge squabbles between them on who
yes,
was going to...
Yes, between Barry, between Morris and Robin, but primarily between Barry and Robin. That Robin felt he wasn't getting to sing enough leads, and he was especially upset over Barry's single from Odessa being released as the first song and not his own, even though objectively Barry's was a much more pop-like song. But he wanted equal footing with Barry, and Barry wasn't about to give it to him.
Of course, Barry was the handsome one with that mane of hair and those beautiful teeth and tall,
relatively
handsome
one.
And yet Robin... I've noticed when I was watching videos, you can't take your eyes off of him. There's something about that overbite and the eyes and those strange facial features that are kind of captivating.
Yeah, he is goofy looking.
Yeah.
But there is something just so pain-filled about Robin that it you do feel compassion for him. And, you know, his vocal approach from an earlier time, he's more like Gene Pitney and the Walker Brothers, where there's this hysteria just building in his voice all the time. And I think that adds to this irresistible quality of his somehow.
Do you think that their ability to harmonize so incredibly beautifully had to do with the fact that they were brothers?
Well, I think if you look at, you know, the great harmonizers in history, so many of them are brothers. The Leuven brothers, the Delmore brothers, you know, the Carter family.
Everly's.
The Everly brothers.
The Isley brothers, the Staple family. You know, it just goes on and on and on that there must be something to that.
Where did Andy fit into this picture? I mean, there comes Andy, and how much younger was he than...
Well, he was like 10 years younger than Barry, or 12, rather. And Barry always said, my family had two sets of twins, but one of them was born 12 years apart. Robin was just a sweet kid, and he was kind of singing... singing in bars in Ibiza, and went to Australia and married someone he was infatuated with there. And then Barry just said, okay, you're ready, come to America. Barry wrote for him and produced for him, and he became the first person ever to have his or her first three songs go to number one.
Now, why was he not included in the group? Why didn't they include him?
Well, I think that's a really fascinating question, and I think it really goes to a lot of various family dynamics. I mean, for one thing, he had a big career as a solo artist, and so he was doing well as a solo artist. The other thing was, I think they had earned their positions as the Bee Gees through how many years of unbelievable toil. And I don't think they were so ready to let their little brother into something that they had killed themselves to have, especially when if he had had fewer personal problems, he would have had such a great career on his own.
He never had to play street corners.
No.
Right, he hadn't.
No.
So it would have been too easy or...
Well, he stepped off a plane and here's one of the greatest songwriters in the world handing him a number one. And it was both wonderful and terrible for him at the same time.
Why was it terrible?
He had self-esteem issues, and he always felt like he had not earned his place, and then, you know, he had terrible drug problems. And maybe he didn't have the hard shell that they had acquired by all those years of being rejected, all those years in the gutter, seeing Song not do it well, proving that they had the stamina, he never had an opportunity to develop it.
We're speaking with David N. Meyer. He's professor of cinema studies at the New School, and he's written for several publications and the author of several books. His latest is The Bee Gees, the biography. And he'll be appearing at Books and Books in Coral Gables for a presentation and book signing. That's tomorrow, Wednesday, September 11th at 8 p.m. That's Books and Books in Coral Gables. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, also author, rock historian David N. Meyer. We're talking about the 40-year career of the Bee Gees on today's program. If you'd like to join in with a comment or question, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email. That's radio@WLRN.org. And also by Twitter, that's @topicalcurrents. David, the Bee Gees had their career was stagnating, and suddenly Robert Stigwood has this idea for this movie and soundtrack, and away they went again.
Yes, it all started with an article in New York Magazine about a disco in Bay Ridge, Queens, and all these dance competitions, and a guy who was the hot dancer there and who kind of ran this little gang. Later turned out that story was a complete fabrication and none of those people existed. But it was a great story. Stigwood bought the rights to it and hired a screenwriter, conceived the movie. The Bee Gees were at a recording studio in France in a chateau that was made famous by Elton John titling his album Honky Chateau, because it was a Chateau Herouville. And many people cut there after that record came out. And they were just cutting songs for the next record. They didn't know they were cutting songs for Saturday Night Fever. Stigwood showed up, kind of told them about the movie, never really gave them a script, and they began to hone the songs a little bit to fit what he was telling them.
Now, we're going to Saturday Night Fever before we get to Jive Talkin'.
Well, okay, Jive Talkin' in 1975, that's their comeback.
Because that was their comeback.
Yeah, that was their big comeback.
And how did they come back from this dip?
What happened was that they got signed to Atlantic Records. You know, Atlantic is run by Ahmet Ertegun and Jerry Wexler, two of the great minds behind so much soul and jazz production. They really understood that kind of music. And they hooked the Bee Gees up with a very important producer for them named Arif Mardin, who had been Aretha's producer and produced a lot of jazz, and Chaka Khan's producer. And he heard a kind of soul in them, and he was the one that advised them to sing falsetto. And so they created Jive Talking, you know, here at Criterion Studios in Miami, and they claim that the guitar riff, the famous guitar riff from Jive Talkin', was inspired by the sounds of their tires going over the drawbridge on the Venetian. That when they hit the metal grating, that their tires mm-hmm. made a sound, and they tried to imitate that sound with the guitar.
And this also was an early use of synthesizer, is that right?
Yes, a very early use of synthesizer. Their keyboardist Blue Weaver, you know, obviously you can hear influences of Stevie Wonder in there, but early use of synthesizer and just so many interesting sounds. I always say, I think it's one of the greatest singles ever cut, and I think if it came out tomorrow, it would be number one.
So what elements do you hear that you're referring to? as we listen.
Well, you hear that Stevie Wonder kind of clavinet that makes you think of Superstition, and you hear those kind of big floaty sounds that you associate with Daryl Dragon, who was the captain in Captain and Tennille and a synthesizer pioneer and played a lot of stuff on Beach Boys record Holland that preceded this that had a lot of those sounds. And you hear just that beautiful, funky chicken scratching on the guitar, which is very much a product of what you might call funky Nassau sound, which was a soul music sound that derived from all these great musicians from all the Caribbean islands playing in dance bands on cruise ships. That's why it's called Funky Nassau. So you had guys from Jamaica, guys from Trinidad, guys who played soca music coming together and making this particular sound that was really tropical. You know, Casey and the Sunshine Band is a kind of flattening and whitening of the Funky Nassau sound. Mm-hmm. But this really has a lot of that Funky Nassau in it. And it, I also say in the book that I think this song is striking for its racelessness, that it doesn't sound white and it doesn't sound black. It's like right in the middle. You know, you play Kool and the Gang, you know they're African-American. You play Casey and the Sunshine Band, you know that regardless of the makeup, they're attempting a very white sound. But you hear this, it's almost impossible to identify. And I think the way Barry sings with so much of contemporary black music in his voice, it also adds to the racelessness of this cut.
So this brought them back.
Yes, this brought them back in a very big way.
And this went to number one?
Yes, this went to number one. America and UK and elsewhere.
So now we've led up to the Saturday Night Fever.
And so who did you say told him to sing in the falsetto?
It was this great producer, Arif Mardin, who produced for Atlantic Record, and he was the one that recommended it.
And it changed everything.
Changed everything. Branded them in a whole new way and gave them an even more distinctive sound, if that's possible.
Now, when was the recording of the Saturday Night Live, Saturday Night Fever?
I know.
Everybody says that.
I do that all the time.
Yeah.
Songs. And that predated them moving to Miami and starting at Criteria and then the Inner Ear business.
Yeah, well, they had been at Criteria for the album, main course, the album that Jive Talking was on. And they went to France. They had some tax reasons, and they wanted an inexpensive place to record. And then, so they started cutting there. And I think that the crudeness of that studio and the absence of distractions, the isolation, I think that contributed to very, very long work days and resulted in this incredibly polished, honed sound that they had that was very much their own. And the other thing we were talking about before is that when they went to Honky Chateau, the people that they were playing with, their drummer, their guitarist, their keyboardist, they had played with for several years. They were really a band. They had rehearsed together, played live together. So when they got together, this was a true working unit and produced this beautifully unified sound.
So when did they start getting session musicians that were not part of them?
That was much, much later. That was after they had started writing for other people in the 90s. But they kept with a real band up through then. And I think it was very, very good for their sound.
The consistency.
And the emotional connection to the music. You know, the session players could outplay them, certainly, but the session players didn't know what it meant, so to speak. It's not their job to know what it means. You know, it's their job to play the charts. But I think when you have a band, somebody you've fought with, drunk with, played with, gotten along with for all this time, there's an emotional connection that emerges in the music regardless of the specific level of technical skill.
And were they touring a lot during this period?
Well, after Saturday Night, they did not tour for like a year and a half after Saturday Night Fever broke, and then they did a gigantic tour that was hugely successful.
So when they did Saturday Night Fever, you said it was heretical at the time to their pop music fans. Is this why they engendered so much dislike from...
Well, what's funny, it was a very curious but classic pop culture arc in that their earlier fans were kind of horrified. And a lot of people say the Bee Gees are to blame for disco. But really, disco was almost fading when they did it. They made disco come back. So their earlier pop fans didn't care for it, but then suddenly everybody in the world loved it, and it sold like nothing had ever sold before.
Well, should we get a taste?
Let's bite the bullet.
Dancing, Bonnie?
I am.
We're all dancing. Everybody's head.
How can you not?
You can't.
We even have a disco ball in the studio.
Well, that adds to it. Great. I don't know how your other guests deal with it, but I think it's appropriate.
I feel like my old DJ days.
David, you said they became a lightning rod for everything everyone hated about disco. You can keep it in the back. Why?
Well, I think because you couldn't hear anybody on the charts except them for such a long, long time that people just got tired of it. I always thought the backlash against them was somewhat unfair, but I was sick of them too at the time. You know, they were so huge and they were so omnipresent. And then also, you know, punk music began to emerge, and the Bee Gees and the way they dressed, their stage presentation, their theatricality, their Vegasness made them a very easy target for all the punk rage. And disco was an easy target for punk rage. And, you know, disco was on the way out and the new thing was on the way in.
We're speaking with David N. Meyer, and his latest book is The Bee Gees, The Biography. He'll be appearing at Books and Books in Coral Gables for a presentation tomorrow night. It's Wednesday, September 11th at 8 p.m. And that's 265 Aragon Avenue.
Can we talk about the drum loop in Staying Alive?
Yeah, we're just going to take a short break, and then we will.
Pardon me.
And we're back with rock historian David N. Meyer. We're talking about his book, The Bee Gees, The Biography. And we'll let our listeners know that we'll have links on both the Topical Currents Facebook page as well as WLRN.org, where you can see more about the book and historian David Myers. David Meyer will have the links there. David, tell us about the tape loop that was the percussion side of that Stayin' Alive and how unique it is. Because it's analog, it's not digital, it's actually tape.
Yeah, I think the tape loop on this song is a perfect metaphor for how underappreciated the Bee Gees are. I think it runs through their whole career.
Meticulous.
Yes, they're a technical innovation. They created the first ever drum loop for this song. First drum loop ever made was invented by the Bee Gees and their producer and engineer. And it was, as you said, literally a loop of tape, a 20-foot long loop of tape with one drum beat on it that they ran through the master heads of the recorder, across a couple of mic stands, through a couple of empty reels of tape. Just picture a recording studio with this loop of tape like a monster running all the way through it. And then each time it completed a circuit, it played one complete drum loop, and they recorded it enough times to do the whole song.
And this was their innovation.
Yes, it was the innovation of all three brothers and their great producer, Albie Gallutin, and their great engineer, Carl Richardson, who worked with them so much at Criteria. But this happened in France because their drummer was in England tending to an illness of one of his parents, and they wanted to cut the track. So they took one of his earlier drum beats and made a loop of it.
We're getting a little short on time, and we're kind of falling behind. But after the Saturday Night Fever surge, then they had this disaster of Sgt. Pepper, movie with Peter Frampton and George Burns.
Yes, absolutely the worst movie ever made. I mean, it's one of those movies that's so bad that it has no virtues, which is very rare about bad movies. And it was all Stigwood's idea, and in their defense, he kind of hurled them into a situation for which they were not prepared, which was how to act. And they had a director who had not done only a couple of movies before and had no idea how to turn them into movie stars. The music was abominable. They weren't doing their own songs. The only good thing to emerge from it is Robin's cover of Paul McCartney's Oh Darlin'. Mm-hmm. And he just tears it up. He does a wonderful job of it.
How about the Bee Gees during their career in alcohol and drug abuse?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as they say, it's hard for musicians to get along when they're all in different substances. And I think that added to the later acrimony. Robin had a terrible problem with amphetamines, and he had it for a long, long time. And to say the least, being addicted to amphetamines makes you cranky. And it upped his crankiness. And then he got clean later in life with the help of his wife, Dwina. Morris was an alcoholic for many, many years, and then made a great effort to become clean and sober and remained so until he died. His fanaticism turned to paintball. You know, he was a great paintball champion, and had a paintball store in North Miami Beach that's still there. Commander Moe's Paintball. And Barry always seems to have been more or less clean, that he never had issues with substances, never had those problems. But for Morris and Robin, it was a tremendous issue.
And their deaths were never linked directly to any kind of overdose.
No.
It may have been a long-term difficulty effect from it.
Well, Morris had a unique issue with his intestines that can occur to almost anyone. It's not linked to his alcoholism at all. Robin's health was not done any good by all his amphetamine use, but he died of cancer.
I just want to go back and talk about Andy.
Okay.
His was drug-related death,
yes, he did not die of an overdose, as all the papers trumpeted, but he died of a heart condition that has always been associated with excessive cocaine use. And it's pretty clear that Robin wrecked himself with coke.
Andy wrecked.
Thank you very much for that. Yes, that Andy did himself tremendous harm with his cocaine use, and it led to his death at the age of 30.
Now, did you speak to Barry?
No, Barry would not talk to me, and Barry asked friends of his not to talk to me. A number of people said they talked to me, Barry would never talk to them again.
Why?
Well, I don't know why, except that the only two books out prior to this are both fan books. They're not objective accounts of their music and their lives. And it also surprised me because no one's written as seriously or taken their music as seriously as I have and really invested in their music. But Barry has always been a man who wanted control. And someone else writing this book meant he wouldn't control it.
He seems to have always been very sensitive to any sort of criticism, as most artists are, but he really took it to heart.
Well, Barry has always had a huge chip on his shoulder, and it's driven his ambition. He never liked anyone outside the family telling him anything about anything.
So how did they survive a 40-year career together, which is so unusual in the world of musicians?
To me, it's the single most fascinating thing about them. You know, I said before when on the air that it's just a rule that everybody in every band hates each other after a while, and nobody really likes being around their family every single minute of their lives. So they had both those dynamics to contend with. But one thing that runs throughout their lives, no matter what, was how much they believed in the purity of what they could create together. And they always recognized that they could make this incredible music together, and they always believed in it. And whatever they had to put up with one another, which I can't even imagine, they put up with to create their art. And I think they don't get the respect they deserve for that either.
Why did you write this book?
Well, I initially wrote it just out of straightforward curiosity, and that it was uncharted territory. No one had ever done it. And then the more I got into their music, the more I wanted to write about both sides, the pain in their personal lives, the difficulty in their personal lives, and what it meant to be able to make this music and sustain this career. And I think their music's great. That was also a big influence.
Now, Robin just died last year, but was it last year?
I think it's 2 years ago now.
Is it 2 years? I lose track. Yeah. He was writing a symphonic piece with his...
Yes, Titanic Requiem, writing it with his son, Robin John, which was performed. And it's been recorded, and I think it'll be performed again. And then last year, I saw Barry's first ever solo concert as it was billed at the Hard Rock Cafe in Hollywood. And now he's been playing in Australia, and he's about to tour in England.
And Barry laments to this day that before Robin died, that they went a year without speaking to each other.
Yes, he was on bad terms, or not perfect terms, with both his brothers before they died. And it seems to be driving Barry to a whole new openness in his public commentary.
Is he talking about it now?
He's really talking about his emotions in a way that he never did before. And the concert that I saw, he was heartfelt when he talked about Robin and Morris.
Why don't you give the books and books information?
Yes, and I just want to ask you quickly, you have a blog, If They Move, Kill Him?
No, it's... If They Move, Kill 'Em, E-M.
Oh, Kill 'Em.
It's a famous line from the movie The Wild Bunch.
Oh,
and my film writing and music writing appears there, If They Move, Kill 'Em.com.
Okay, so we've been speaking with David N. Meyer. He will be at Books in Books presenting his latest book, which is called The Bee Gees, the biography. It's Books in Books in Coral Gables, and it's tomorrow evening at 8 p.m. It's located at 265 Aragon Avenue. And I don't know if they'll have music there, but you'll be there.
I'll be there. I'll be reading and taking any questions and signing books.
Okay. Well, it's been a real pleasure, David N. Meyer. He's a professor of cinema studies at the New School. And the book is The Bee Gees, the biography. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Apologies to the callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org, and more information and links as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program looks at end-of-life issues. The fastest-growing American population group is over 85 years old. We'll speak with Katie Butler, author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. And to the calendar, on this day in 1934, 79 years ago, the birth of newsman and producer Charles Kuralt in Wilmington, North Carolina. Most famous for his On the Road segments, he died in 1992 at age 62. 2 years later, evidence showed he had a two-decades-long shadow family with a Montana woman. And on this day in 1953, Swanson Foods introduces the first TV dinner. It was turkey, cornbread dressing, frozen peas, and sweet potatoes. The price? 98 cents. It cooked for 25 minutes at 425. No nukes then. And one more. On this day in 1990, 13 years ago, the Hard Rock Cafe opens in Las Vegas. It has a 30,000 square foot casino, 6 restaurants, 3 bars, and a music venue called The Joint. Currently, there are 175 Hard Rocks in 53 countries. In 2007, the chain was sold to the Seminole Tribe of Florida, and they are now based in Orlando. We leave with a thought from Charles Kuralt. Thanks to the interstate highway system, it is now possible to travel across the country from coast to coast without seeing anything. This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Next, it's Here and Now from NPR News.